The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
The chapters we had went through previously, the first chapters of the book of Amos, were prophecies for Gentile nations. And they quickly, though, moved to condemnation for the house of Israel to the north. And some verses include the house of Judah to the south. Now, if you don't have your Bibles open already, let's go ahead and open up to the book of Amos in chapter 5. And these prophecies that were given and that we will continue to read, it's a lot of terrible things that Amos described, with all of the pain, the suffering, and the death that would come as a result of millions of people who refused to obey the ethical values of God. This was a hard thing for the people to hear, but it was also very difficult for Amos to speak and to write. And even God did not take it lightly. I mean, this would have brought tears to the eyes of Amos, and some call this next chapter a mournful spectator chapter in the sense of how Amos must have felt. And so let's go ahead and read the first verse of Amos 5 and verse 1. "Hear this word which I take up against you, a lamentation, O house of Israel." And so this is not only expressing Amos' sorrow, it reflects God's lament at the need to carry this out. You see, God had started this by bringing the descendants of Jacob out of Egypt, where they were enslaved because of their idolatry in that land. He called them to be an ideal nation, but not just an idea, but a model of what all people should strive to attain through having an intimate relationship with the one true God. This relationship included making a marital type of covenant with God, in where he promised the children of Israel that he would be faithful to them if Israel would be faithful to him. This relationship is mentioned very briefly and in part in the next verse, in verse 2, where it says, "The virgin of Israel has fallen. She will rise no more. She lies forsaken on her land. There is no one to raise her up." And of course, speaking of what would occur to the house of Israel. So Israel was once considered to be a virgin when God brought her out of idolatry in Egypt, and he baptized them in the cloud and sea, as Paul had pointed out in 1 Corinthians 10. She was meant to be a light on a hill where people would see the integrity of these people, the prosperity that they enjoyed, and they would want to be like them at being a part of such a righteous system. This is reflective of something that the nation of America experienced. You see, we started out on biblical principles, and people once wanted to be a part of that. They wanted to migrate here and to be a part of something that had integrity, something that was honorable and that they could prosper along with. But the opposite has happened. You see, Israel became a witness to the world of what not to become. As God said to Amos in a previous study, when we had read in Amos 3 and verse 9, "All you nations gather on the mountains and witness what will become of those who reject my ways." And so it happened to them, and it will happen to us. That is this nation. Sadly, we still have not learned this lesson, and America and Great Britain and other nations will become an example of what not to be like. So God will bring the wicked nations down, no matter who they are, whether they have the law or not. We had read about that, and we had just read that there will be no one to raise them up, he said in verse 2. Nobody on the earth, that is, will be able to restore them as a people. But as we know, God will restore Israel as a nation one day. Sadly, it will not be until most of those people have been wiped out. Amos 5 and verse 3, "For thus says the Lord God, the city that goes out by 1,000 shall have 100 left, and that which goes out by 100 shall have 10 left to the house of Israel." God said that they would not return to the state that they were before. He here indicates that a remnant shall be left. And we had again read about that and discussed it in chapter 3 when he said that they would be likened to a lion and its prey being consumed. And if a shepherd were able to take some away afterward, only there would only be an ear or maybe two legs left. The use of the numbers here in verse 3 is also describing the remnant. And it is an interesting number, or two interesting numbers that God uses. He says 10 out of 100, or 100 out of 1,000. It's a tenth of the people, is what he is talking about. Such a small amount of people when we consider the millions of people that would have existed. And what this portrays is a tithe of the people, a tenth of the work of our hands. Now consider the concept of tithe, if you will. A tenth of the work of our hands is to be dedicated to God, to serve his purpose. And so I speculate here, could this tenth, the remnant that would be saved, could they also represent a tithe of the people that would be saved to fulfill God's purpose around the world? And when it comes to the ultimate fulfillment of these events, serving Christ's purpose when he returns. In other words, when all is said and done, is it possible that there will only be 10% left when Christ returns? Shocking numbers to consider. If you have a bookmark or something, a ribbon perhaps, put it in Amos 5, and I would like to turn back to 2 Chronicles chapter 30 for a moment. What is not known about this prophecy's past fulfillment is if the tenth refers to the number left alive, or perhaps a number of people that were left in the land, actually able to stay in the territory of the southern kingdom of Israel. It would have been the northern kingdom of Israel. It may be that it refers to a number left in the land, and some history in the scriptures back up that opinion, and it's found in 2 Chronicles 30, and we're going to read a few verses here, but I want to read verse 1 first. As we know, Hezekiah was a good king to the house of Judah, and he restored worship of the true God in that kingdom, but this was after the house of Israel had already fallen to the Assyrians. Now verse 1 says that Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, and also wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Eternal God of Israel. So here he is reaching out to all of his kin, his brothers, the other tribes, saying, come, we are restoring worship of the true God here in Jerusalem at the temple, and we want you all to come and be a part of it. But the house of Israel had already fallen, or at least most of the people were gone. Jump down to verse 5 here. Verse 5 says, so they resolved, speaking to the people that he had reached out to when these messages were sent, they resolved to make a proclamation throughout all Israel. This is when he's still gathering the letters together. To make a proclamation throughout all Israel from Beersheba to Dan that they should come to keep the Passover to the Eternal God of Israel at Jerusalem, since they had not done it for a long time in the prescribed manner. Then the runners went throughout all Israel and Judah with the letters from the king and his leaders and spoke according to the command of the king. And here are some of the words recorded. Children of Israel, speaking to everyone, every tribe, return to the eternal God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and he will return to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria. So there were some that were left in the land, a small number. Could it be that 10%? And he goes on to say, do not be like your fathers and your brethren who trespassed against the eternal God of their fathers, so that he gave them up to desolation, as you see. In other words, it's you see what's happened and what the state that you are in. Return to God. He wants you to come back to him. And so could it be that this remnant that is documented here are the people who escaped? The ear and the legs taken out of the mouth of the lion, the tenth that God spoke of through the prophet Amos. Let's go back to Amos now, back to Amos 5. And we will read verse 4. For thus says the Eternal to the house of Israel, seek me and live. So this is a continual message to everyone from God. While nearly everyone we might know and see are going the other way, God says to seek him and his ways, and we will live. Verse 5 says, do not seek Bethel, nor enter Gilgal, nor pass over to Beersheba. For Gilgal shall surely go into captivity, and Bethel shall come to nothing. What is described here, or I should say named, are sites that were set up as religious places. They were established in Bethel, Gilgal, and Beersheba, but they were not religious places to God at this time. Perhaps they once were, but now they had turned to idolatry. Many had already sought spiritual refuge in the idols of those places, but none of that would do any good because those were nothing but wood and stone, nothing that could save them. Only God could save them. And the enduring message is to not seek refuge in the things of this world. Do not try to be comforted in places or people or things that will ultimately fail. Only through Jesus Christ can we find safety and freedom from the bondage of corruption. Verse 6, seek the Eternal and live, lest he break out like fire in the house of Joseph and devour it, with no one to quench it in Bethel. This is a continual warning. But notice, it's not just a warning. It's a threat. It's not just a matter of, I desire for you to follow my lead. He's basically saying, obey my voice or else. And notice that it also refers to the house of Joseph. Now, the house of Joseph is, of course, speaking of his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so why mention those two specifically when the northern kingdom consisted of 10 tribes, not just two? Well, I believe that the reason lies in the fact that there is a duality in these prophecies for those nations today that have Jacob's birthright blessing, that blessing that was passed upon the children of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh. And so consider who we are as a people, as a nation, descendants of Joseph. And do we have idols today like they had in Bethel and Gilgal and Beersheba? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Consider, there is a form of worship in whatever a person obeys. And so today, some people worship fornication or adultery, pornography. We worship social media in the sense that people spend vast amounts of time on the internet and little to no time reading the Bible or seeking to obey God. People worship musicians or sports or drugs or alcohol, motorcycles, and the idols of our age actually number in the thousands. People have gotten so caught up in pleasure and materialism that the nation seems to have vastly forgotten God. Leaders of this country act as though he doesn't even exist, and the worship of the creation as itself has been occurring for a long time, looking at the creation as the creator of life instead of looking to God as the creator of all life. And so we see that the more you take God out of society, the worse the society becomes. Because when there is no God, that is when people think that there is no God, then the morals of the Bible are simply just ideas of men fabricated by people with an agenda. And so people are instead devising their own agendas, and they are not afraid to use lies and deceit and to hurt others in order to get what they want. And so we have a justice system in this country that was established by its forefathers, and it was just at one time. It's called the Department of Justice. It consists of a number of organizations, including the FBI and the CIA and others, our judicial system. But we see that it has now been weaponized. Our own government is using a justice system to push forward an evil agenda. Now, notice what God says about this kind of thing in Amos 5 and verse 7. You who turn justice to wormwood. It's an expression referring to poison. And you lay righteousness to rest in the earth. In other words, you try to put the righteousness in the grave. And those that are righteous, you would rather them be dead. So you're killing people with your wicked form of justice. And you don't seek truth. You don't seek righteousness. You want to murder the righteous. And just in case you need some credentials of where these words came from, God goes on to say this in verse 8. He made the Pleiades and Orion. He turns the shadow of death into morning and makes the day dark as night. He calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. The Eternal is his name. Some translations begin verse 8 by saying, seek him who made the Pleiades and Orion, just so people are not mistaken who is being talked about here. So God caused the sun to shine, and he made it so it would set on the horizon. He is the one who made the day, and he also brought in night. To bring those things into existence out of nothing is what I would categorize as a super miracle. And yet, more is mentioned that is miraculous. God can raise people from the dead, described as turning the shadow of death into morning, like causing the sun to rise. And he did cause the sun to rise, and also caused the Son of Righteousness, that is, the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, to rise from the dead. He created the sea and all that is in the sea, but God also brought a great flood of the waters of the earth, the flood of Noah's time, by opening, as it says, the fountains of the deep. This is God calling for waters of the sea. He's poured them out on the face of the earth. Yahweh, or the Eternal, is his name. In verse 9 of chapter 5, he rains ruin upon the strong so that fury comes upon the fortress. Now, verse 9 is phrased differently depending on your translation. I have a couple of translations right here. The King James, I'm reading the New King James Version. The King James Version says, he that strengtheneth the spoiled against the strong so that the spoiled shall come against the fortress. It's a little more wordy, but it's making the same point. The Complete Jewish Bible phrases it as, he flashes destruction on the strong so that destruction overcomes the fortress. They're both correct. All three that we have read are accurate. God can cause the weak to become strong and the strong to be feeble. He does not only do what he wants, but God does exactly what is appropriate according to the situation. If it is fitting for the wicked to be destroyed, then they will be destroyed. Nothing is going to stand in the way of the one who created the stars and put the constellations in their place. As it says in Isaiah, I am God and there is none else. He is God and there is none like him, declaring the beginning from the end, or the end from the beginning, saying his counsel will stand and he will do all his pleasure. And his pleasure is righteousness. It is what is right and good for everybody involved. Again, leave a ribbon or a bookmark here, and let's turn to the New Testament in the book of 1 John. 1 John chapter 2. Think about it. All of the galaxies throughout our universe, galaxies that are billions of miles away, are believed to be moving at 180,000 miles per second. Can you imagine? Numerous solar systems exist and planets rotating astronomically by forces that, you know, we only speculate about how they work. And these are all the work of his hands. Do you see how ridiculous it is to put anything in life before God? And how important it is for us to heed what he has to say. Notice what he had to say through the Apostle John in 1 John 2 and verse 15, where we get this encouragement and instruction to not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now, you and I might say that, you know, we love music, or we love French fries, or we love to go swimming. But what that means is that we really enjoy it. That is not what God is saying here. He's not telling us to stop enjoying life. God created this world and the things in it for us to enjoy, to use for a good purpose. What he is saying is, don't get carried away. Do not let the things of this world move us away from our devotion to God. In other words, do not love the world more than we love God. Put nothing before him. It continues to say in verse 16 of 1 John 2, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away. In other words, it is corrupt. It is corruptible, and it will pass away. And the lust of it will pass away, but he who does the will of God abides forever. Amos 5. So we understand that when all else fails, when everything else in the world comes to an end, and it will come to an end. Everything that is created that is physical will eventually fail. And we'll look back and we'll realize that it was God. And that we could count on God to bring us through. But God is telling us through the prophet Amos, don't wait to look back and regret. Recognize this vital, enduring truth right now. In verse 10, it talks about those people who are righteous and preach righteousness, and the general consensus among the wider population is that they hate the one who rebukes in the gate, and they abhor the one who speaks uprightly. So the tendency is to hate the ones who tell us that we are wrong, that we need to change. And they hated the prophets of old, and they even killed many of them. They hated Christ. They killed him. And he said to his disciples, you will be hated by all for my namesake. But he also said to them in John 15 and verse 18, he said, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. So there are some that will not hate you because they are on God's side. They want to be with God. But consider, we being Christians, people of God in this way, that the animosity or the what's described as hatred here that might come, it comes with the territory. It's a part of the job that we signed up for. It's in the job description. You know, we were told to count the cost. So don't be surprised when it happens. The wicked are selfish, and they have little care for those that they might hurt if they are going to get something out of it. Amos 5, in verse 11 this time. Therefore, because you tread down the poor and take grain taxes from him, though you have built houses of hewn stone, yet you shall not dwell in them, You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink wine from them. So he's talking about the wickedness that was going on in the administration and people that, you know, that were in positions of authority, that they wouldn't think twice about hurting those that had little or those that had less if it gave them something else. And they would build palaces and they would heap up treasures for themselves. In fact, this is the tendency of human nature to spend most of our lives trying to heap up treasures. But there's nothing wrong with having some things to enjoy. But the point is to work ethically, to do it in the right way, in a godly manner. Because if you work to gain things without reverence and true obedience to God, all of those things are going to be taken away. And even if people might enjoy it to a ripe old age, in the end, you know what they say, you can't take it with you, right? Wealth and status in this life will have no value in God's kingdom if we were not righteous. So remember what Christ said. He said, "He who is the greatest among you shall be as he who serves." And so we are to have that mindset of a servant, somebody who in the eyes of others might consider to be below them. But God says, no, that kind, those kind of values, those kind of people, they are of great value to me. And verse 12, again, talking about the evil, "For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins, afflicting the just, taking bribes, diverting the poor from justice at the gate." Terrible. And don't we see things happening like that today? Oh, yes. In verse 13, "Therefore the prudent keep silent at that time, for it is an evil time." Because the righteous people became more disliked, they found it wise at times to keep their mouth shut in fear of their lives. But this is not God telling them to keep quiet so they can save their skin. It's a choice that people have to make, because there is a time to speak and there is a time to keep silent. Something similar is happening today. I mean, think about this throughout the country of America and other Western nations. For years, many people kept silent about the immoral aspects of the leftist agenda in society for fear of being labeled a racist or a homophobe or a fascist or being canceled in the media. You know, the left has chosen all kinds of names to use that are inaccurate to describe conservative people, but people don't want to be thought ill of, so most kept quiet. Right now, we see many beginning to speak up. And whether or not they should is debatable, but we look at it, we applaud the rejection of evil, of course. It's refreshing to see some people not afraid to stand up and say, no, that's wrong. You know, that's something that ministers are responsible to do, but we all have our place. We all have our moments in time to speak up, but remember this principle. This is something to think about in this regard. Christ said in Matthew 7 and verse 6, he said, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under feet and turn and tear you in pieces." In other words, the words that you say to some people, they're going to care less about. They'll trample them under their feet and then they'll turn and attack you. Not all people, but some people who did this. And so sometimes, what Christ, I think, was getting at, sometimes it's not worth taking the chance, because recognize that in some cases it's not going to do any good anyway, and it actually might bring us harm, or it might bring harm to someone we love. But regardless of what we may or what may or may not happen to us, we should always do what is good according to God, and we should stand for righteousness. In verses 14 and 15, Seek good and not evil, that you may live. So the eternal God of hosts will be with you as, I guess that was part of the verse 13. No, it wasn't actually. It's hard to see some of this print in my Bible sometimes. It's very small, and I also have notes written alongside of it. In any case, yeah. Verse 14, seek good and not evil, that you may live. So the eternal God of hosts will be with you as you have spoken. Hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. It may be that the eternal God of hosts will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. So we can be a part of that remnant, the remnant that is saved from the destruction of the children of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, those people who received the birthright blessing. We are a part of those people, and we live in a type of the northern kingdom, where it was a nation that once had laws and principles that were righteous, and therefore the birthright blessing does not mean we have guaranteed salvation. No, that's something that we have to reach for, we have to strive for, we have to qualify for. Verse 16 says, therefore, the eternal God of hosts, the Lord, says this, speaking of the time of destruction. There shall be wailing in all the streets, and they shall say in all the highways, alas, alas. They shall call the farmer to mourning, and skillful lamenters to wailing. In all the vineyards there shall be wailing, for I will pass through you, says the Eternal. So much grief and sorrow is spoken of here, and skillful lamenters, as it was a tradition of some to hire people to come in at the death of someone they love and to mourn with them. Mourning and sorrow in the streets. Can you imagine the heart-wrenching sound of people wailing because of a massive loss of life? God says that they will not be passed over, but that he will pass through them. And it brings to mind the angel of death that passed through the houses of Egypt and took the lives of many, and the great wailing that took place after that horrific event. Next, God speaks to the people who anticipate God's intervention and tells them, don't look forward to this time. Verse 18. Woe to you who desire the day of the Lord, for what good is the day of the Lord to you? It will be darkness and not light. It will be as though a man fled from a lion and a bear met him. So trying to get away from being ripped apart and being torn apart by something else. Or as though he went into the house, leaned his hand on a wall, and a serpent bit him. So people won't be able to escape it. Is not the day of the Lord darkness and not light? Is it not very dark with no brightness in it? We associate the day of the Lord as the time of the trumpet and bowl plagues leading up to Christ's return. But the day of the Lord, this is an expression that refers to any time when God powerfully intervenes to bring justice to the wicked or to change the course of history. Some of the people that this was sent to at that time may have been aware of the prophecies, for example, those of Isaiah speaking of a time when God would eventually set Israel as a pinnacle and a beacon to all the nations of the earth. And perhaps some thought that this would be the time. What they may have overlooked is the fact that this was a time when God would bring justice to the wicked people of Israel. Even if those who anticipated this were decent enough to be spared, God says it's not something to look forward to, for obvious reasons, that many people would suffer profoundly. And so we too should not look forward to the coming suffering for anyone. But we should have sympathy and compassion for people, for their pain and for their loss, even if we do not agree with them morally. It is sad to see such suffering to have to take place. And so we do look forward to the return of Jesus Christ, of course. but we do not look forward to the day of the Lord. There will be great devastation, enormous death and pain and plagues and destruction throughout the entire world. It will be a very, very sad day for mankind. Even though humanity has brought this upon themselves, we don't want to desire it to come to anyone. What we do anticipate, what we do look forward to, is what will come afterward. The resurrection of the chosen, the return of Jesus Christ, and the beginning of God's kingdom on the earth. In the next three verses, God speaks of religious celebrations that he did not institute. He said, I despise your feast days, and I do not savor your sacred assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them, nor will I regard your fattened peace offerings. Take away from me the noise of your songs, for I will not hear the melody of your stringed instruments. Some people in the professing Christian world, perhaps Catholics or Protestants, they might think that this refers to the feasts that God had established and that he now wanted those feasts to be abolished. Such a thought is entirely false. God would never say that he despises his own holy days, something that he sanctified, or that he hates his own sacred assemblies. The true worship of God is a beautiful thing. The songs of worship to him that are pure and right and good are pleasant to his ears, and the offerings, he said, of righteous people are described as being a sweet savor to him. What God was talking about here were misuses of his feasts, and he speaks of days and customs that were designed by men that might appear appealing or beautiful to us, you know, with its decorated trees and its treats and its lights and its colored eggs, but to God, he abhors these things. He finds no beauty in Christmas carols or other songs that actually are paying homage to false gods. In verse 25, did you offer me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? Did they? Yes, they did. However, look what it says next. You also carried Sikoth, your king, and Chiun, your idols, the star of your gods, which you made for yourselves, designing your own gods. He's talking about false gods. And so it appears that this ideology remained with them after they left Egypt. You see, God had to re-instruct them about his commandments. He had to reteach his holy days. And they served God in the wilderness. But they came out of idolatry, a nation rank with idolatry. And it's that we see right at the beginning there when they fashioned the golden calf, they brought this idea of false gods with them. And so they had many gods while they were in Egypt in bondage. But it appears that ideology never entirely was left behind. Of course, they waxed and they waned, but more frequently they waned in their devotion to God. In the last verse here, in verse 27, therefore I will send you into captivity beyond Damascus. That's the capital of Syria. So beyond that place, says the Eternal, whose name is the God of hosts. The story of ancient Israel is a tragic story of things that had occurred. They didn't occur before Amos wrote them, but they occurred approximately 30 years later. And they continue to be an example of human inconsistency. You know, it seems to be a part of our human nature. But you see, the nature that you and I have is not entirely natural. It is tainted by the prince of the power of the air. And you and I still have the ability to refuse those man-made holidays, to refuse idolatry, to refuse putting anything before God and practicing those traditions that God hates. We can put away the lust of the eyes and the flesh and the pride of life, those things that would cause us to not choose God. And so the warning for them continues to be the same threat for us today. Choose God and live. Do your own thing. Follow the ways of this world, and you will be destroyed.